I was going to start with saying good afternoon, everyone, but I think it's fine to say good evening. And welcome. Thank you very much, all of you, for coming. I am absolutely delighted to welcome the Foreign Secretary and His Excellency, the High Commissioner of Bangladesh, to LSE and to the first South Asia Center event this evening. Some of you who have been around in LSE long enough, either because you're in senior courses over here, I don't want to say any of you have failed, but all those who do come will remember that we had a fantastic Bangladesh event last year in June with Professor Amartya Sen. And we have several future events coming up on Bangladesh, of which I wish to mention only one in particular, which is a summit on Bangladesh, a day-long event that will coincide with the Ralph Miliband lecture on the 5th of June this year, and it will be at the Sheikh Zayed Theatre in the new academic building. It will be all day long from 9 o'clock in the morning, and will include the plenary lecture by Professor Nala Kabir at the Gender Institute here at the London School of Economics. My name is Nilanjan Sarkar. I am Deputy Director of the South Asia Centre. The lecture today is an occasion, and I'm delighted to see Mabrur, who was here with us for an earlier event that we did on this very important and unfortunate issue. I think it is fair to say that it is an unfortunate issue. It's very important for us because several of us at LSE, and when we visit higher education institutions here in London at least, which I do, a lot of the debate, including the earlier one that we had at LSE, of which the two of you were a part of, so I'm delighted to see you, tends to focus on the role of Myanmar, the errors of Myanmar, and the larger human tragedy that so many of us are witnessing with enormous sadness. We rarely get to hear, outside of television interviews, which are very limited, we rarely get to hear the story from the perspective of the government of Bangladesh. And in something that I have written recently and will become public in due course, I have actually referred to Bangladesh's response to this enormous human tragedy as iconic in the world. I've actually used that word because I genuinely think it is iconic, that this response from a nation, people coming from another nation, confronted with an issue that is in no way caused by Bangladesh, but it has accepted with open arms. I cannot possibly think of a more appropriate person than the Foreign Secretary of the Government of Bangladesh to speak to us about it. Mr. Mohammad Shahidul Haq is the current Foreign Secretary. I have promised not to read out a long and eulogistic introduction for him, what in South Asia is called a Prashasti Patra, which I promised not to do. But I did therefore want to say something, because I had the privilege of reading about his life, that of the many interesting things that his profession has allowed him to be a part of, I noted with a lot of interest that his undergraduate and master's degree, which he did from the University of Dhaka, was work in social welfare. So it is not only his current position, but also a wider sensitivity that must be long grown to be able to speak with empathy on this kind of a human tragedy at this scale. I'm not going to give you numbers, because you're going to see the numbers just now. The topic we chose was purposely wide-angled. It's called the Rohingya Humanitarian Crisis and Bangladesh's Response. The Foreign Secretary has very kindly agreed to take questions afterwards. I have my own questions, but please do also hear him out carefully and ask him questions. In the very little time that I have just spent with him, I feel confident that you can ask him a lot of things. I'm not going to say you can ask him everything. It is also my very pleasant duty to welcome His Excellency, Mr. Mohammad Nazmul Khamis, who is the High Commissioner of Bangladesh to the United Kingdom. That's a position he has taken up in 2016. We hope to see you more frequently at the South Asia Center, and we hope to hear from you at a later time. But thank you very much for making the time to come this evening. I also wanted to thank the various other officials for the High Commissioner, especially the Deputy High Commissioner, who has made it possible so much that we are doing in Bangladesh. I won't go on further. The Foreign Secretary will speak first, and we can then decide how we want to do the question and answer. I'm going to move away because I want to see the PowerPoint, but we take it. If you would like to stand, there's a microphone.
Good. Good evening, distinguished participants. What I'll try and do is quickly run through some of the slides. I thought that I may not use it, but nevertheless, I will use it to give you some informations and then take questions. I can assure you that I'll not cross 20 minutes. That will be the maximum that I will speak because I don't want to do a monologue. And afterwards, let me tell you, you can ask all questions. If there are issues that I don't want to speak about, I'll let you know humbly that this is an issue. I'm not going to give my views, but I think by asking questions, you can also give us a sense as to where the LSE students are thinking in terms of this humanitarian crisis. Now, if you look at the slide, this is our Honorable Prime Minister. I think it was 7th or 8th day of arrival, of recent arrival of Rohingyas into Bangladesh. And she went to meet them, even when her security were not very comfortable, her going into the camp. So I thought this I should put in because it was her policy to keep the border open, and the border is as of now open, and welcome these people.
Yeah, you just do the end.
Yeah. I know you have a very good knowledge of the geography and the location, but nevertheless, I wanted to share with you, because I don't know whether the students of political science here or not, you'll see that this area has a very geostrategic and geopolitical locations. It is China, India, Thailand, Laos, Myanmar, and this is the area which is Bay of Bengal. I discuss the geostrategic location of Bangladesh and vis-a-vis the Rohingyas and how it has a global geopolitical implications. I will not talk about that today. This is how they started crossing over. In fact, we were, I have a colleague, Iqbal, we were there on 23rd of August in the bordering area just to see for ourselves how things evolving. And this is an exodus of, I think, 26th or 27th of August. So my one of my questions when I sit with my Myanmar colleagues, I said, when it comes to return, you are asking about verification of their identity. You're talking about whether they were resident in the northern Rakhine or not. But when they came in like this, in large numbers, disparate situations. There's one or two posters at the back. You'll see the misery that they brought along. Now, this is the fastest growing displacement. Within 3 months, we had 1 million Rohingyas. It has never happened in the world, nowhere, not even in Europe. This is also not the first flow. I'm sure that all of you know. The Rohingyas came to Bangladesh in 78 and 79. There's over 200,000. Some of them went back, some of them remained in Bangladesh. Then they again came in 91 and 92. That number was about 250,000. And some of those who came still in Bangladesh, and they are what we call 300 undocumented Rohingyas from 2005 and 2015, because some went back and some remained. There are also recognized refugee camp where Myanmar government and Bangladesh and UNHCR has done all kinds of verification and decided that they are refugees and they need to go back either to Myanmar or somewhere else. So there are 34,000 refugees from 91 and 92. So then comes over 700,000 in 3 months. So that makes, in fact, this is a little old figure. The latest figure is 1.1 million. And that's what I put, Rohingya flow continues despite all our efforts to bring it down. This is a very interesting slide. The Kutupalong camp is the largest camp in the world of refugees. Largest camp. Nowhere anyone near to it. It is, I think, now hosting about 600,000. Because this slide we made two and a half, three weeks back. So this is what it is. I am sure that if there are questions, I'll be very happy to answer. Now, the way we see this is that it's a multidimensional and multi-layered crisis. Often people ask me, why you think it's a multi-layered crisis? The reason being that when initially they came in, we were talking about giving them shelter, food, medicine, and the rest of it. The nature of the problem, the face of the problem was very plain and simple. And gradually we are now realizing that there are other layers in the crisis, which is the atrocities that they faced in their own country, which actually compelled them to leave there. It is, in terms of dimension, it is a border issue, environmental issue, social issue, and political issue. It has the potential to destabilize the region, because that's where Bangladesh, India, and Myanmar comes together. And that area has always been little fluid in terms of informal economy, in terms of various kinds of flows. So that's why the people who come from the political science background, for them it is very interesting that this is a multidimensional and a multi-layered issue. There are still issues which I think we'll have to wait to see in questions I'll answer. Now, faced with such a situation, having the experience of receiving two flows earlier, what we did. The first thing we struggle. Like any other state, we also struggle that what we do. Should we close the border or should we keep people coming in? Prime Minister in this was very determined and very humane. We had meetings where she said, look, in 1971, when we were struggling for our independence against Pakistani occupying forces, 10 million of us crossed over to India. In fact, there was a time when Tripura's population, our refugee population was twice than the Tripura population. The reason I mentioned Tripura, because recently there was an election and somebody got elected who was conceived in Bangladesh and born in Tripura, became the chief minister recently. So, and then she said that I have been, I'm talking with Sheikh Hasina, our prime minister, that I have been refugee and I exactly know what it means to be a refugee. So let the border be open and they come in. So that's why we opened the border, and border, as of today, it is open with Myanmar. I don't think there's any other example globally, where we have kept, they have kept the border open for refugees the way we did. The second one is that we allowed UN and international agencies and the media to come. In the past, in the past there were two flows, and on the both the occasions, we struggled and not allowed international media to come and see. This time we thought enough is enough. The kind of things that has happened to the life, it should be brought to the notice of the world, because it is becoming a recurring phenomena. So that's something we do in terms of our response. And we also realized that the families that were coming in, overwhelmingly children and women, 58% children, 30,000 women were pregnant, 36,000 now we see orphan. They came alone. They left behind their both parents, and some of them never came back and joined them. So we are struggling with this particular group. And then 7,777 children, where both the parents died. Now, where they died and what happened to them, that's a question that international community should ask Myanmar government. So we allocated land, set up camps. In fact, our civil administration and military was called upon to set up temporary camps. Still, the civilian administration and the military are there to help the Rohingyas. And then we also this time decided that we'll have the registration, so we know who came in and at what time with what. This coincided with August and September UNGA. We debated internally. We talked to our friends whether we should take this issue to the United Nations. In the past, we did not. We always used bilateral approach to solve it. This time, we decided, and our prime minister took the issue to the UNGA, where she made a statement and some bit of it here, including making a proposal, where 5-point proposal as to how we can peacefully resolve it. So this is what it is. I'll not read it for you, but you can certainly, I'll leave the PowerPoint behind so you can look at it. So this is part of the response that that you are seeing, that we continue to host them, and we think that they should go back when things are right for them. This is the camp. I don't know, anyone have been to Cox's Bazar, to the camp? Only one, two, three, four. Good. So you know more than I do. So you can contribute. This is part of the camp. This used to be a deep forest for Bangladesh. We don't have much forest, but whatever is left is there, and it has gone. You'll see some of the other pictures, satellite pictures, before and after. So the movement of refugees didn't only hurt our economy, but also hurt tremendously our environment. It will take billions of dollars to recover the forest land. Now, as you, those of you monitoring now, you'll know that we are facing now different kind of a challenge in terms of arrival of monsoon, and we are aware of it. There are three things could have happened. Could happen is flood, landslide, and cyclone. So this is one. And also, there could be declining international assistance to these people. So this is something we are currently struggling with in terms of our response. And I'd be very happy if there are questions on that. Sorry. Now, our policy towards this population movement. Let me just flag, this is not between Bangladesh and Myanmar. We had never had any conflict. We never had a war between the two countries. It is between Myanmar and their own people. We happens to be caught in between, that I often say. And these people have come and took shelter in Bangladesh. So that's where it is. it is not interstate conflict. So our objective was to create a stable environment when these movements were taking place, and whatever response we formulate eventually, the government, it has to be human right based, and peace has to prevail. There were time when we were struggling as to if these people continues to walk through after crossing Bangladesh, what could have happened. Say they didn't settle there, they decided that they will walk and walk over Bangladesh. Some will stay in various districts, others will cross over border and go somewhere else. That could have been a huge emergency, not only for Bangladesh, but also for South Asia as a whole, especially the countries which are contiguous to ours. So that's one. So this time we had a mixed of bilateral and multilateral. That's a major departure for Bangladesh, because we thought that this recurring humanitarian issue has to be addressed in the international forum. Bilaterally, we are not able to solve it. Absolutely. So out of that conviction, we took the issue through our Honorable Prime Minister. But kept the door open for the discussion, and that's why we have bilaterals. We also decided that not only UN, we'll also take it to the rights entities, human rights mechanism, and we did, and there has been a number of sessions, resolutions, fact-finding missions. It's continuing, and we also engaged with friendly countries to make them understand what that has happened. Because, you know, to our utter surprise, when people were walking in a desperate situation, there were news coming out of Myanmar that these are all fake news. There's a huge propaganda and saying that no, these are not real, these are all made up stories, this is to malign the government and, you know, to bring down the democracy in Myanmar and all kinds of things. So that was quite a news. So we I have my counterpart, who is the permanent secretary in Myanmar. I said, come and see. Let's go over and see who is coming and who are there and how they are coming and why they are coming. He said, I don't have the mandate to do that. I said, well, you know, you have the mandate to say these are fake news not to come along and see. None of them has ever agreed to come over and see what their policies have done to millions of people. We have also hosted UN bodies and others in the past, whereas in the past we have not allowed anyone to visit Rohingya camps. Through bilateral window, we currently have two instruments, actually. This is a kind of an umbrella framework instrument that we signed for safe return of Rohingyas. And this is the physical arrangements, the details as to how many camps would be there, who will receive them, who will take them back. And then we set up a joint working group to solve this problem. I head this joint working group. And from Myanmar side, the permanent secretary for the Foreign Office heads it. So this is currently in place. We have negotiated this, and now since we negotiated these issues and had a long discussions, hours after hours, days after days, and there's very interesting discussions which when I retire, I'll write a book so that everybody can learn as to how they looked at these Rohingyas. It's very interesting. You can read and sort of read their face and see how human being can look at another human being the way they did. Okay. In the past, when we had the arrangement, this is not the first time. Earlier, there was also similar arrangements done. We did not think about once they go back, what happens to them. Because as a state, we thought it's a state responsibility to take care of the people. We had refugees. In fact, there was a crisis in Bangladesh also with our hill tracks people. 61,000 left Bangladesh. And they were brought back. They are currently mainstreamed. They have representative in army, they have representative in police now. In fact, in the foreign service, in fact, one of our ambassador in Mexico comes from that community. So we have also brought them back. In fact, it was Honorable Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina during her previous term has decided to bring them back and assure them all kinds of safety and security. That's what we thought that Myanmar will do the same. You know, they cannot behave the way they behave. So this time we said we have to be assured that once you take them back, that their rights are established. There are three things, very important things, and we struggle with it. One is their non-criminalization. You cannot brought in cases against them, those who have crossed over the border, because immigration cases could be brought against these people, Rohingyas, and put behind the bar. So there's a legal provision state can use. So if that they cannot do, they cannot discriminate, and there has to be resettlement and reintegration. And these are very technical terms which comes in from the 1951 convention. So despite our own limitations, we have kept protection of human rights and discrimination. And when we were trying to make our colleagues from Myanmar understand, that was quite a task. And I think, but they were, because of the international pressure, they wanted to have an arrangement to show the world that problem is solved. We have agreed, so there is no issue. That's what they were thinking of telling the whole world. Because we were also surprised when they accepted these issues. Because they accepted, I don't know with what intention, because I see that they are not very sincere about their commitments. Now, what next? What are we suggesting? Let's not have repetition of atrocities. We are saddened, we are angry to see how people were treated in the Rakhine state by their own military. We also think that the Kofi Annan Commission report, which is a very comprehensive report, that should be implemented because it is their report. It is not an international report. But international community should continue to create pressure so that Myanmar agrees to implement whatever they agreed with us. And I think the Myanmar government has to revisit their outlook and policy towards Rohingyas. They see Rohingyas for their religion, for their ethnicity as a problem. So they want to get rid of the problem. I think they can be a part of the solution, which they never looked at. So we have encouraged Myanmar colleagues that why don't you take these people as a resource who can also contribute building the country. This is how some of the international community colleagues looking at Bangladesh being very responsive and responsible. When we were thinking about our policies, we said we have to be responsive and responsible. We have to remain human. You know, it's not easy. You know, our finance minister said that when 1.1 million people walks across your border, this is like launching an economic war against a state. And you know, it had, if you were not able to contain it and address it, it could have destabilized Bangladesh. Now the question is, return is fine, reintegration is fine, but the injustice that has been done, what happens to that? The issue of accountability. You know? We have talked to women who have been raped 19 times in 3 days. What happened to those women? The children born out of a conflict, what happens to them? Now, the Myanmar government saying that they have burned down half of their villages. It's their official statement. That's why they have invited China, India, every country to come and build houses for them. So there's no denying the fact that they have burned down the houses. And there are satellite pictures of that. What happens through that? They have also, in the name of fighting terrorism, they have killed about 20,000 people. What happens to that? Some of the mass grave that we see now coming up, what happens? So these are the questions that international community need to answer. I think I have done 20 minutes, below 20 minutes.
You've done very well.
Yeah, so I'd be very happy to take questions.
Would you like to sit and we can do the Q&A?
Yeah.
I just wanted to say one thing. We will have reason to thank. There was a very important statement that the Foreign Secretary made at the beginning, which was that he said, in the context of when the refugees had begun to come, that the Honourable Prime Minister of Bangladesh, Sheikh Hasina, said that I have myself been a refugee. Is there anyone in this room who does not know how Sheikh Hasina became a refugee? Is there anyone who does not know their story? You like to speak?
Yeah, exactly.
Because I think that's very important to the story.
Absolutely. You know, the whole country was a...
Why don't you sit and talk?
I feel very comfortable when I stand. Then I can see everybody, how they're making their face. Okay. Whether they're liking it or not.
What happens is, you know that Bangladesh was born through a struggle in 1971. I hope your generation reads 101 history of South Asia. So at that time, about 10 million Bangladeshis had to cross over to India. How old were you, Najmul?
Myself?
Yeah?
10, 11 years.
10, 11 years. So that's, I think, few of us still around who have gone through that this phase. But what happened is that after our independence, where father of the nation, Bangabandhu Sheikh Mujibur Rahman, took over the country, there was still a struggle, internal struggle going on. And he was assassinated in 1971 through a coup, military coup. 75. And along with his family members, only two of the family members survived because they were in Germany on a trip. It's the Prime Minister and Sheikh Rehana, the sister. So those are the two surviving members. The rest were assassinated. And then there was a military rule because of which Honorable Prime Minister was not allowed to go back to Bangladesh. So she initially took her refuge in Germany and then subsequently in India. So that is the story, and that's why she was in that status in exile for 6 years before the military junta could allow her to come back. So that's how she feels the agony, the pain, the frustrations and hopelessness of refugees, people who are not able to go back to their own country.
Thank you. The reason I raised this question was because it's very significant to the larger narrative that is unfolding. As it happens, I spent my childhood in the neighboring house of where Sheikh Hasina was living in Delhi. And she clearly looks much older than I remember her to be. And India at that time was getting very close to having recovered from an emergency. But it is one thing to see expressions of people who are refugees. It doesn't matter how poor or how rich you are. But it's the knowledge to know that you cannot return to your own country, which is very, very significant. That's the reason I raised it, because I think it's very central to the narrative. I have some questions to ask, but I think we should open it up for others. But I did want one clarification from
yes.
you. You referred quite a few times to friendly countries, that Bangladesh has spoken to friendly countries. Who are the friendly countries?
Okay. Britain, because Britain was the chair of Security Council, is a permanent member of the Security Council. United States, all European countries, Southeast Asia, Indonesia, Malaysia. Who else? India initially had difficulties, but even Turkey, big way. So these are the friendly countries. Even some of the African countries, Latin American countries who have experience dealing with these kinds of refugees, they are on this particular issue is a friendly country to Bangladesh and to the Rohingyas. And you have noticed that I have left out a couple of important countries.
Are there any questions? Rahima, you want to? Do you want to ask?
Why not we take three questions and okay. Lump it together?
Yeah.
Sure. Yes.
You want to ask? Yeah. Go ahead. You're right in front. Yeah. Do you just want to introduce yourself so we know who you are?
Hi,
yeah.
I'm Shalini Jaiswal. I'm doing a master's in international relations at LSE. I'm really interested in this topic. So you spoke about putting your questions further about the friendly relations. I wanted to know what is the Bangladeshi government doing in terms of multilateral arrangements that you spoke about in South Asia. How are the South Asian organizations responding to your the crisis that is happening currently? And more importantly, what about Southeast Asia? How is Bangladesh tying up with Southeast Asia to deal with the crisis?
Hi, my name is Tamana Meshmi. I'm a third-year undergraduate at the London School of Economics. I study politics and international relations. I founded both the Bangladesh Society and the Human Rights Society at the LSE. My question to you is, as students from a bottom-up level, what can we do in support of the crisis? Because as students, we've done a lot of fundraising, we've done the cases of doing events, we've worked with Restless Beings, and we did a human rights event on this crisis. But in terms of the bottom-up level approach, from a humanitarian and policy perspective, as a British Bangladeshi, you feel an obligation to your home, and you feel somewhat powerless watching these scenes unfold on social media and on the news. What can we do as students? We are a very political university. We, as a union, we stripped Aung San Suu Kyi of her honorary presidency from the LSE Students' Union. And as a student body, I'd like to know what we can do.
Good. Can we take that? Yes,
Mavru. So first of all, thank you so much, not just to yourself, but also to the government of Bangladesh. Truly is remarkable, the response that Bangladesh has provided. I have a question which is maybe three or four layers deep, and I hope it's you can say with me. I just wanted to understand the rationale behind using a bilateral approach towards the repatriation, given that the Honourable Prime Minister at the UNGA mentioned the need for a safe zone. Why mention on a multilateral UN level and then go ahead and do something on a bilateral level? Secondly, alongside that, obviously you also mentioned that you're quite skeptical about Myanmar's response and whether or not they're actually quite sincere. So far as policy is concerned, what possible caveats or policy recommendations do you have in place if that repatriation process does actually fail, as you suggested that it might do? I have loads of other questions, but I'll leave it for that.
Please go ahead.
In terms of multilateral institutions, as I've said, in South Asia, SAARC has not taken up this particular issue, and SAARC is not supposed to, as the charter suggests, to take up refugee issues. In fact, SAARC avoided both the migration issue and refugee issues for quite some time. Why? That's a complicated answer. So we have not activated the SAARC mechanism, if there is one. On the ASEAN front, as I said, that we have been engaged. In fact, both the Indonesia and Malaysia, to some extent Thailand, Philippines, have engaged both in mostly in the humanitarian side, but also in terms of supporting these issues in the UN, especially Malaysia and Indonesia. both in New York and in the Security Council, because it has debated in the issue has been debated now 4 times in Security Council, but also in the Human Rights Commission. So that's there. The other front where these issues could eventually end up, this also relates to your question, is the whole issue of the international criminal court structure. There are a number of avenues there. Some of the UN agencies are talking about it. Some of the NGOs are talking about it. Individuals are talking about it. Countries are talking about it. But it is, I think, not yet mature to take there. I think the ICC has to take cognizance of this of these atrocities, and it will take a little more time in terms of reaching to that stage. what students can do? Students can do miracles. Keep the issue alive in the international system. That's what we want. It's not a question of taking care of 1.1 million people. As the Prime Minister said, that if we can feed and take care of 162 million people, we can also do another extra million. That's not an issue. The question is their rights. The question is that whatever has happened to them, how the international community will look at it. So keeping the issue alive is extremely important. As you know, that the attention span of international community is very, very short, because there are a number of issues, especially the things blow up in Syria and others. So the attention has gone towards Syria. So in order to keep the attention live, so that there are pressure on the Myanmar authorities to do justice to these people, it is very important that student continue to keep little more radical on this issue in the campuses. This is what the message we are also spreading in United States and other places wherever we could, that keep the issue alive. In your studies, in your meetings, in discussion like this, so that's what we expect at this stage. And if you think that you have the appetite and stomach to go and live there for 7-10 days, most welcome. Come and see how people have been treated. This is a huge experience. I'm sure that some of you will end up in the field of development and dealing with emergencies. It's a very good place to see how humanity lives in difficult situations. On the issue of, what happened is when Myanmar approached for an arrangement to take back their what they call resident. They don't call them national, they don't call them citizen, they call them resident. They give a condition that Bangladesh and Myanmar will negotiate and finalize the agreement without the presence of any UN agencies. So that came from Myanmar government, number one. Number two, but in the agreement that we had strongly argued for involvement of UN, especially UNHCR, in the implementation of return. Myanmar did not agree. In that, facing with this, we said that, okay, from our side, we will engage. We have already engaged, so they will be with us in implementation. That they agreed, that Bangladesh will collaborate and implement with the support of UNHCR, but they kept their one kind of a vague, saying that at an appropriate moment they will also engage with UNHCR, but not at this stage. So that's where it is. I wish we could sit down with all the states and and had the negotiations. But at least we have something which could be followed. This is, you know, there are times when optimists also get disillusioned and gets frustrated. So we are almost in that stage of seeing the resolution of this issue in a peaceful manner. Because I think the Myanmar authorities wanted to get all the Rohingya Muslims out of their country. I think maybe there are 100,000 left altogether, all over the places. The rest, they have successfully washed out. Their current policy, as I did, is to maintain the status quo. Whatever has happened. They need Bangladesh to support their policy and let these Rohingyas go wherever they want to go or whatever happens to them. They shouldn't return. That is their current strategy. And to achieve that strategy, they are employing all kinds of tools and methods. If you read their messages, if you see how they behave like Germany behaved during the Second World War. I don't have any other words to say. Because now they are, I think 2-3 days back, they have sent out a note verbal, you know, the communication between one state to another, saying that, you know, they are ready to take Rohingyas back. Bangladesh is not sending them. So they have let the whole world know, thinking that that's what the whole world is going to believe. So they have a very good propaganda machine, trained the way Hitler regime trained its own propaganda machine, and using it against a particular community. Because some of the things that have been said is absolutely incorrect. Number one, you know, they think they are, the Rohingyas are Bengali from Bangladesh. That's the first narrative. Okay? So they should go back to Bangladesh. Second is they're all terrorists. So they have sent us a list of 430 people of terrorists who they think are hiding in Bangladesh, so they should be handed over back. And within that, there are as young as 3 years old children's name. So either somebody made a mistake by putting the whole family as a terrorists, or something went wrong. I don't know. So that's the second narrative. Eh? And the third narrative is the sovereignty and security of Myanmar is a threat. So they have every right to deploy whatever they want to protect their sovereignty. I don't think there's an issue. I mean, among the ethnic minorities in Myanmar, the Rohingya is the only one who has never taken up arms, because they have never thought in that way. You know, it's a very, for political scientist, it's a very good case study why a particular community never thought in terms of their future and unity and leadership. If you ask the Rohingyas, those are in the camp, that who is your leader? They'll say, my dad or my mother. I said, but you know, that's your father and mother, but uncle. Stops there. They don't have a political leader. They don't have a leader who they think could lead them into safety and security. That's a tragedy. So why a particular ethnic community of 1.5 million has never thought in terms of, you know, in terms of politically looking at themselves? That's something, a very interesting ethnographic study that could be done. And if you ask them what they want to do, they would say that we would like to go back to the Burma land. That's their standard answer. They want to go back and have the property that they used to have. After so much of an atrocity, so much of a rape, so much of a abuse, how a nation wants to go back to the same is also a question. And if we hear that these are all terrorists, then we literally don't know how a state could do such a thing to their own people. So this is a very long answer to three short questions.
Thank you. Any other questions? Oh, lots of questions. And I'm going to ask my question before I let others ask questions. It's actually a factual question, which I thought may actually help with generating more questions. This is not, as you yourself said, this is not the first time the Rohingyas have come to Bangladesh. They came earlier. And you used a very interesting word while describing their status. You said some of them remain undocumented. And this is the group that came between, you know, they were up there in your diagram. Why have they remained undocumented?
I'll tell you.
And in relation, is what I was wondering might be useful for all of us to know. I know very little of it, but I know a little bit, is what were the other reasons that brought them to Bangladesh earlier? When this kind of a flushing out did not happen. Can we just take some other questions?
Yeah.
You raised your hand first, or at least I saw you first. If you can just begin with introducing yourself.
Yeah, I'm Aditi. I'm from Press Trust of India, and I was writing about the Tribune. So since you're here, I do need to ask what, during your dialogue, strategic dialogue with the British government, this issue would have been discussed. What's the latest that you were able to update them, and what was their response? And also, on a slightly wider point, if you could give a bit of an insight into the strategic dialogue.
Ah, so that is a strategic dialogue question. Where is our Director General?
Sorry,
get ready for that.
Can we just take some?
We'll take the question.
Yeah.
We'll answer your question.
Yeah. Can we just take some other questions? And with due respect to Aditi, but if we can let the others ask, because you have a specific professional question to ask, but we'll definitely take that. Yeah,
yeah. We'll answer.
You wanted to speak. Yeah.
Hi, my name is John Owens. I'm a freelance journalist. And with everything you said, you very powerfully spoken about Myanmar and its approach to these people. There have been plans to repatriate Rohingya starting in this year, as you well know, of course. What is the situation with regards to Bangladesh at the moment and repatriation with all that you said in terms of what they will be returning to? And if I may ask one other, if that's okay.
Now that you've started.
in terms of radicalization within camps, have you seen any evidence? Is that a concern at all? And if so, what is the response to that?
Okay. Sorry, if I can just interrupt. Are there any other journalists? Okay. I only have to say one thing, which is part of LSE requirement. If you were to go back and report, please specify the context in which the foreign minister is speaking and make clear that he's speaking at the South Asia Center at the London School of Economics, not say just London School of Economics. Because this is a big case, so that there is absolutely no misinterpretation about the context in which this has been said. Okay.
And if something happens, I can take refuge to UK. Yeah?
The
journalist has to, I'm sure they work under an ethics. So
yes,
I'm sure.
Right. No,
so far in 6 months, I've been speaking to many places. And I can say that they have been very ethical,
sure.
Correct, and making sure that they don't kill the source.
Yeah. No, I'm sure they have. I didn't mean it in a pejorative way. I just wanted to say this because it is required of me to say it at LSE. Rahima, you wanted to ask a question, and you.
I'm from the organization called Restless Beings. I just wanted to say.
What is that?
So much. Restless Beings.
Restless Beings.
The three groups actually from the organization. I just wanted to say thank you so much for what was a very engaging, insightful presentation, and also just how empathetic you were. And the Humane Made, which I think you presented some of these facts and figures. There are actually 78,000 people now left in Burma.
78,000?
Just 78,000. And we've been working with the Rohingya community for the last 12 years. The kind of work that we do is a research base for a research advocacy organization. At the same time, we're also a registered British charity. And we have an international activism movement working with universities like LSE and up and down the country. We work very closely with the governments like Malaysia and of course the Bangladesh government, and we have been terrific being a host country. My question is, at the same time, I will ask a little bit about some of the environmental issues, and we've got an environmentalist in the region at the moment, so we make several trips every few months, and looking at sort of the wild elephants that are coming back.
Yes.
Of course, in what was a very beautiful forest is now covered with miles of camps. My question is about the repatriation that you mentioned earlier. Last month, Reuters released some images of an island in the southern coast of Bangladesh, which will potentially be funded by China and developed by China. I just wanted to know if you had any sort of information about this, because there's obviously discussions of Rohingya being moved to this island, a very uninhabitable island where it experiences cyclones all the time. Do you have any thoughts on this? Do you have any inside information on this? Anything on this? It would be interesting to know, because obviously we don't want to just go by what Reuters releases.
Yes.
Thank you.
You're wonderful.
Yeah, my name is Nima. I'm with Rest of Things as well. Obviously, going to refugee camps, we saw the scale of how.
When were you there?
Just 2 weeks ago.
Oh, 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
It's much better.
Yes, yeah. Compared to how it was last year. We made 6 trips last year.
Oh, you went.
Crazy. So
did you went during the month of August and September?
We were in September.
Terrific.
Okay, please.
So we saw how heavily, obviously, populated these small areas are. We talked a little about what Bangladesh government will do for the monsoon season. I just want to kind of emphasize on that. Just ask, like, what are Bangladesh's long-term solutions? Like, what are the government doing to ensure thousands of Rohingyas don't die during this monsoon season? There are, you know, we saw thousands of children there unable to swim, obviously, and obviously because it's such a small area.
Okay. We have taken a couple of questions. There's one question as to why, from you, why I was. Ita dao, ita o slide ta.
The
slider, just a 1.1 million.
This one.
No, I have it. What happened is, there's two large flow. There's two large flow. So after 91 and 92, through a similar arrangements, bilateral arrangements, some of the Rohingyas went back, and some remain in the camp, waiting for return. And in 2005, unilaterally, Myanmar stopped taking any more Rohingyas. So that's why this number was 28,000. It has grown into 34,000. Now, what happened between 2005 onwards, that people in a small number continue to come and started taking shelter adjacent to the Kutupalong camp, one of the camps. They were in the makeshift. Now, these people were not... were not registered by anyone. But gradually the number increased. And they remained undocumented. In fact, in February 2016, we decided that we'll do a census. So we did a census. And there is a full-fledged census report waiting to be published. That's why we are quoting this 300,000 from there. While we did the census, we also told them that after the census is completed, it gets published, we'll give you a card. So that was the process of making them undocumented. But till then, they were undocumented. How this word came in 2013, in September, there was a debate in the cabinet on these issues, that these people and these people, what do we do with them? Because we were not able to create a bilateral mechanism to take them back. And the Myanmar government has totally blocked that path. So the cabinet decided 5 things. One is that let's do a census and see who are they, when they came in, how many children are there, and then give them some kind of a document, number one. Number two, we said our border has to be stronger because it was threatening the border. The third, that we have to take care of their shelter. And that's how very coordinated way of interventions from the UN system and from the government of Bangladesh was put in place in 2013. So when the this large influx started, before there was a presence of UNHCR, IOM, and others, I was given the responsibility to coordinate. So that's why they're undocumented. And somehow or other, that terminology remained undocumented, but there are documents, there are census report, which we eventually did not publish. It's with the government. In terms of British discussion, yes, this is an area where the British government and the people, I think, were extremely disturbed, vocal, both in the country and also in the various UN forum. It was discussed. There will be a joint declaration coming out, hopefully tomorrow, and there is a strong para in terms of working jointly together in helping the Rohingyas there. Today, when we were discussing in our strategic dialogue with the Sir Simon Douglas, the permanent undersecretary, we have a strategic forum. This is the second one. The earlier one was in Dhaka. We had discussed this quite at length, also in the presence of our colleagues from the other agencies of the British government. So that's something very encouraging. What else that's there were in the strategic dialogue?
Just to add, I mean, the strategic dialogue is giving two governments are bringing in their respective perspective on the priorities. I mean, where we have priority, they have a different kind of approach. So this gives you kind of a balancing your priority and go for a more broader relationship. And this is coming at a time. And UK is leaving the European Union and Bangladesh is graduating from LDC towards a middle income country status. So status quo is changing for both in a different way. So we are trying to map our priorities and then go for a more engaging and more win-win kind of partnership.
Yeah, good. I'm sure that once you see the declaration, joint declaration coming out, you will see that there was a very substantive discussion, long discussions on many issues, many issues, including Rohingyas. And the British government is making further commitment, not only politically, but also in terms of aid, making available for the Rohingyas. On the issue of repatriation, we know that return and repatriation has never been an easy subject, and we are aware of it, and that is the reason when we had this agreement. In the agreement, we have kept a provision under which, once Myanmar government tells the whole world that they are prepared, we are supposed to go and see what that they have prepared. If you look at the current camps, it looks like anything but a human-friendly place to live. I'm not uttering the word that I should. I hope you can read my lips. So that's what it is. Our Prime Minister has made a commitment that they will be sent back in safety and security and in a dignified manner, and we'll live up to our commitment. So the international community should not be worried as to how the government of Bangladesh is going to send them back. We will only send them back when things are safer and secured for them on the other side. The other downside of not returning is that's what actually Myanmar authority wants, that they should never come back. And they are creating all kinds of a condition and propaganda so that these people never come back out of fear factor. And then they can implement their grand design. They are setting up a cantonment, export processing zone, and all kinds of things. On the issue of radicalization, certainly it's a huge concern for us. we are keeping a strong eye on that, and you'll be happy to know that there were at least on two different occasions when we had to remove some people from the camp, those who went to help. Also, I'll not name one INGO was not allowed to go and work in the Rohingya camps because we had specific reasons for barring them to go to Rohingya camp because their past history wasn't very very good. In terms of environment, yes, I think the major shock that has taken is the environment, and it's continuing because so many people in so little place. In terms of Varshanchor, we have 146 islands. These islands, some of them are normally people stay there 12 months, and there are certain islands which are used by the fishermen who go deep into the sea to fish. This one, the Varshanchor, is that kind of a island. And the Prime Minister has asked our Navy to develop. Not with the no business of Chinese. I don't know why did you pick up this. don't believe that. This is absolutely with our own funding. Our Navy is developing that area, making it habitable. We are planning to make accommodation available for about a community of 100,000. There would the advantage there is that they can then do the deep sea fishing and help the fishing industry because that's what they used to do. And also, that place is currently there's a lot of cattle and other things, so it's a very there's a lot of sweet water in that. That's one of the basic requirements. So we have given a British company to make this place habitable with the government of Bangladesh's money. So it's no Chinese installations, for heaven's sake. And we hope that once this place is ready, we'll take the international community and the media to show that this is where we think some vulnerable community, Rohingya people, should come if they so wish, and try and build a community there. So because issue of space is a big issue. In Cox's Bazar. Okay. In long term, you know, there's a saying in philosophy or economics. They say in long term we all are dead. So we are not thinking long term right now. We are thinking short term. But at least we are looking between now and December. We hope that this will not again become a protected refugee situation. So.
Should we take the last round of questions?
Yeah,
we have 10 more minutes. This room is booked from 8. If you don't mind, if I could give the gentleman a chance, and if you would introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Goff. I'm a second year student in class. So I was wondering, like, we were discussing the Burmese government, and I was wondering if your opinion could be changed in any way, or from either from top-down approach or bottom-up approach in the short term, as that, because I don't see this happening in the
You're talking about the repatriation. I see.
Just the attitude. Okay.
Sorry.
Your question?
Hi, I'm Emily. I work for the Southeast Asia Center at CLSC. I've been following the situation from more of an ASEAN Southeast Asia perspective. But my question is actually about your government's response to the upcoming monsoon and cyclone season. If you could talk a bit more about what you're doing in practical terms to help
Okay.
Hi, I'm Farha. I'm studying international migration and public policy. I'm also from Bangladesh. regards to integration into the Bangladeshi society, if a repatriation fails and we don't see it in English, like now, then is it possible, for example, with policies such as banning Rohingya and Bangladeshi national marriages, things like that, like how are it, would integration be possible? Are we looking into
good.
That at all?
Yeah. Good.
Very briefly.
Yes.
Foreign Minister
okay.
Of Burma from the UK government. And obviously I'm sure you're aware that 100 of our MPs last month also signed a letter calling for an ICC referral as well. Pardon me for my my tone, I don't mean in this way. Why does Bangladesh officially not call the Rohingya Rohingya? Why does it officially, on all its official documents, refer to the Rohingya as forcibly displaced Myanmar nationals?
Okay.
And also at the same time, sorry, with Tumru, and obviously last week we saw there was a big military build-up there. What's happening on the border, and also kind of related to that in Aslan as well, we know that there's a potential 4 million people who could potentially be even bigger catastrophe than the refugee crisis, if you have any comment on that.
Good.
Okay, very briefly, yours.
Just 2 points of clarity, if possible. Just to check with regards to you saying about thinking short-term between now and December. I just wanted to clarify what specifically meant, whether it was about the island or about the repatriation.
No, it's about the UN joint response plan that I was referring to. Because the UN had a contingency plan taking care of these people till March, end March. So they need a plan along with that contributions and funding to look at that. And it has been finalized yesterday. It will be launched tomorrow in Geneva.
Thank you. And one other point, if that's all right. Just British company who are making the island have...
I don't know the name.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. So we're going to take, if you give very brief answers, and then we'll just conclude our announcements.
Okay. On the zero line, it's very interesting. The last time we met with the two joint working groups, 15 and 15 of us, we said that some of the Rohingyas are staying at the zero point. So those people have never crossed over to Bangladesh. Why don't you take them back? That's much easier. So we didn't know that we'll be triggering a military buildup by just mentioning that. So and then we had a flag meeting between the two border forces. And they agreed that they will pull back the build-up that you're referring to. But they are yet to do that. So these are some of the things I think is pure provocation. On the issue of why Bangladesh at one stage not calling Rohingyas and Rohingyas, in 2013 we went for an official consultation. So, this was a debate whether they're Rohingyas or they're Bengalis from Bangladesh. So we had a long discussion and we came up with a kind of a solution. I said, whatever you call them, these are your people. So we said that, okay, we'll not call them Rohingya. You don't call them Bengali. There'd been an agreement. Call them by any name. And then Aung San Suu Kyi said, they are Muslims from Rakhine. Fine. If a state wants to call their own nationals in that under this title, we have no problem. So that's why we stopped, and then we realized that it was some kind of a ploy. We stopped calling them Rohingyas, but they continued to call them Bengali. So we have now calling them Rohingyas. I think that agreement is no longer there between the two states. So that is the reason. On the issue of marriage and integration, I prefer not to talk about it. But we are not looking at a long-term integration of Rohingyas in Bangladesh. The reason being, if we do that, actually, then we made the Myanmar's policy of ethnic cleansing successful, and that's what exactly they want. They think that if they stay in for a longer period in Myanmar, they eventually will get amalgamated into Bangladeshis. Although we have a language problem, we don't really understand unless we are from Cox's Bazar. In fact, the Cox's Bazar people have difficulties understanding Rohingyas as far as the language is concerned. So that's the reason that we are not looking at integration. We think that they should go back and live in harmony and safety and security. On the issue of cyclone situation, let me assure you that government of Bangladesh has already taken steps to ensure that when monsoon comes, these people continue to remain in safety and security. The Prime Minister has already allocated some additional 500 acre of land, because these are the reason I'm saying the Prime Minister, because these are forest land. So we need a special parliamentary approval for cutting down forest and making it habitable. And that can be only overrided by the Prime Minister, given the imminent monsoon. We have the Prime Minister decided, let's take another 500 in addition to the 5,000 acre of land that has already been habited by them, to give them, to bring out at least a few families, not few, at least 15 to 20,000 families from the top of the hill to this new area that's currently being done. We have also done in terms of, because when they came in, the first thing occurred to us is the health emergency, and someone who has in between left the government job and dealt with Afghan refugees and Iranian refugees and all kinds of things, I know that the first is not food, not shelter, is the health, because there's likelihood of cholera, malaria, and all kinds of things. So that we give a special focus. So there's number of hospitals, filled hospitals, also by Turkish, by Malaysians and Indonesians. That we did. And now I think in terms of health emergency, we have averted a major crisis of diphtheria, some of you would know. But the continuing concern is the cholera, breakout of cholera. So that we are taking care of. And the other issue is the security, because at night when the light goes off in the camp, it becomes a huge dark space. And that's where we are thinking of getting some electricity in the camp. But let me also assure you on behalf of the government that, you know, since we have given them shelter, we'll also make sure that when they are in Bangladesh, their life or the property is not at risk. In terms of attitude, how are we going to change the attitude? That's something the Myanmar government should be doing. Because Myanmar government should understand that there is a multi-ethnic and religious country. And they have to really work to make sure that minorities feel safe, secured in their country. If they haven't done it, they must learn it from others. And there are terrible things that can happen if you are not taking care duly of your minorities, both in terms of their rights and in terms of their future. And that's why Myanmar government is struggling with all the ethnic communities. It's not only Rohingyas, with all the ethnic communities.